Welcome back to the Out of the Woods, your go-to podcast for threat hunting insights. I'm your host, Scott Poley.
I am Tom Kostura.
And in this weekly segment, we break down the stories, tactics, and insights that matter most to threat hunters. Let's jump into the top threat hunting headlines for July 21st, 2025. So, Tom, what do you got for us this week?
All right, so we're going to kick it off with one that's probably been loud and noisy in everyone's ears, but I figured we'd give it a few minutes to definitely talk through it from our perspective and things we've seen. Scott, I know you've dove quite deep into this one. But we have an article from Microsoft titled Disrupting Active Exploitation of On-Premises SharePoint Vulnerabilities. So Microsoft security team revealed active attacks exploiting multiple zero-day vulnerabilities in on-premise SharePoint server versions, subscription edition 2019-2016. But does not affect SharePoint Online. So the CVEs involved are 2025-49704, which is a remote code execution code injection. CVE 2025-49706, which is a authentication bypass or spoofing. And then there are a couple others that are like patch bypass variants of both of the ones I just mentioned that enable further exploitation. So Microsoft also, as this has kind of progressed, because this has been going on for a few days now, in this article, they mention some attribution, specifically calling out three China-based groups that have been confirmed through their side to be actively exploiting this. So we have Linen Typhoon, Violet Typhoon, and Storm 2603. There's also plenty of reference to other people attempting and or exploiting these bugs. So what attackers are doing with this? So they're basically exploiting the HTTP host request to the slash toolpane or the dual authentication endpoints. And they're uploading a web shell. One that's been commonly called out is some version of spinstall.aspx. And they're using that to steal the ASP.NET machine key data by using an IIS process worker or that W3WP.exe. People might be more familiar with it from there. And it's invoking a command shell to execute Base64 encoded PowerShell commands. So from there, you can see extraction of cryptographic keys, which are needed to kind of forge that view state encryption key. And after that, they're able to perform full code execution, implant backdoors for deeper compromise. So a couple things that I picked up, Scott, and I'm going way on the top level here, so I'll let you dive into it more. But a couple things that I picked up from like the detection hunting strategies that people could consider. It's kind of looking at one that I know we've talked about this before. We've also done some hunts around this before. So kind of monitoring for that IIS, that W3WP.exe spawning like a command or a PowerShell, especially when it's in carrying over with those Base64 encoded commands, right? And then looking for web shell indicators. So you're kind of looking at the kind of paths that they're talking about here, that spin install. And that's really specific for this, because that could obviously change, because there already are variants of that. And I wouldn't rely on consistent naming for that either. But it's just a soft one out of the gate, because it's kind of a hellfire with this vulnerability right now. And then looking for those network logs, potentially, to capture those kind of unexpected post requests to that slash toolpane or that dual authentication. So, you know, Microsoft has issued emergency patches for this vulnerability and has stated that any on-premise internet facing SharePoint server should be assumed compromised. This is, you know, they're shouting pretty loud about this one. And then also seeing as recent as I believe this morning, CISA added these to the KEV catalog, which I think we both would have assumed that it would happen, but they're there now with the urgent warnings that they carry. And, you know, I'm fairly certain the majority of the listeners are aware to some degree of this one, Scott, but, you know, I'll pass it over to you since you had your hands in it more and see what else you can add and tell us some more depth about this one.
Yeah. So this one was kind of fascinating in a couple different ways. One, to kind of talk through the 0 day, territory. There was two bugs presented, and they were in Berlin's Pwn to Own. And I think I've talked about the Pwn to Own competitions, but Pwn to Own is really fascinating to me because from a, you know, vulnerability patch management priority perspective, a lot of people focus on highs and criticals, and the lows and mediums are like, if it happens to get patched, it gets patched in a lot of instances. But pwn-to-own competitions, a lot of times when the people actually are able to achieve victories, they're typically taking advantage of multiple mediums or low vulnerabilities, kind of played together and working together to get their complete compromise, whatever, to achieve success. And there were two vulnerabilities that happened that were discovered in May in the Berlin's pwn-to-own. And it was they basically bridged two things together, and it was a remote code, unauthenticated remote code exploit execution that put together two vulnerabilities. Now, this latest one is kind of a variant of those two. But I like to call that out because it just kind of shows the significance on, it's not specifically, you know, what the vulnerabilities potentially expose you to, but also where is the system also exposed physically or architecturally and things like that that come into those considerations. But with this vulnerability and the exploitation of it, that's interesting is, yeah, they are kind of going after a kind of a legacy web part editor in SharePoint, which is that tool pane, ASPX. And so that's being leveraged. But what really makes this also applicable is they forge a referrer header. So a lot of times when you navigate within the realm of a site, or going from site to site, the referrer is going to be, you know, what took you to that site? What site were you on previously? And in this case, the referrer they forge is in the layout directory as well, path on that website on the SharePoint, but it's calling out the signout.aspx. And by doing that, it basically tricks SharePoint into saying, oh, well, this is an authenticated person as well. So you kind of get this authentication by setting up that specific referrer and hitting that legacy web part editor. And by doing so, now you have basically access. And then the specific web shell, if you want to call it that, that gets dropped, it's also interesting because it's not your typical web shell. So it's basically they're dropping an ASPX because of the type of web server it is, into the template layout section so that it can be called on and then it will run. But it's not your typical web shell where, you know, you have this interactive ability where you kind of have this session now that you can kind of call in and do that dynamic interaction. Instead, it basically leverages where it actually pull out cryptographic secrets and able to access things there and then dump those in a JS file where a lot of things are written to that you can then access remotely. And then you have those keys. And why that's important is, you know, they pull the validation key, the decryption key, signing algorithms, all that kind of stuff. And those values are used by ASP.NET to validate and decrypt the view state payloads. So when I say view state payloads, there is a URL that you're able to go to, right? And it's, you know, it's a git command, web git to the SharePoint page that goes to the layouts success.aspx, and there's view state and then equals. And in that view state is usually a serialized command, whatever it is you plan on running. And the way it gets created is it uses the key and everything there as well. So if you have the keys, you can pass whatever you want to that view state and run whatever you want, right? That's kind of how it works. So there's a couple different steps, right? There's obviously you're vulnerable and people are hitting your site a certain way. Then they're dropping something to extract keys. And then when they get keys, they're going to be doing hitting that view state. So there is things you can look at if you have that visibility into just the web traffic alone. Obviously, looking for ASPX creations or file creations within, especially the layouts template directories, a good thing to look forward to. But why I love this so much is, yes, it is a zero day. Yes, there are things that if you didn't have that, all that technical stuff that has been published wasn't available, like, what would you do, right? That's usually the biggest thing is, like, how do we find the relevant information to protect ourselves when these 0 days, especially with these types of things that are public facing, happen? But that's why I kind of like our threat hunting approach to things like this, because we know that because it's a SharePoint web server that is W3WP.exe is the basically process that manages and runs that. And it typically has a kind of default behavior of being a web server driven process. So when you see it spawning things like command.exe or PowerShell or things like that, that is not normal behavior. And without knowing anything else, even if this was a, let's say, a 0 day that hasn't even been announced yet, because that hasn't even been discovered, if we were actively hunting for different ways where our servers were getting exploited, right, web servers, just looking for that behavior of what w3wp.exe spawns, very powerful, right? You can always just kind of keep a kind of a check, so to speak, on just the current behavior at any given point in time, and rerunning that and comparing. You might be able to catch things before even researchers and other people stumble across them. You could be the researcher that, you know, discloses these types of things. So yeah, that's what I think is really cool about some of the approaches. And we're looking at post-exploitation, right? Sometimes, you know, what's great is you hear these, there's really bad vulnerabilities. And then your process of, do we patch this right away? How urgent is this? Especially if you don't know if there's any exploit code out there. At least if you discover things by looking for post-exploitations, you know how important it is, right? There's no like, hey, this could be bad. We don't know when it will be bad. And so sometimes when you have resource strength constraints as far as how to address things, that's hard decisions to make. And then also in the attack chain, they had cmd.exe that was spawned from W3WP, but that also then spawned PowerShell, which ran an encoded command. So just looking for just typical behaviors that are nefarious, like PowerShell encoded commands. Also looking at script interpreter spawn chaining, I call it, right? Command prompt spawning PowerShell. Another good thing to look for. Now, this is the other thing that I think that needs to be called out that people need to be aware of, though. Let's say you do find that you had some SharePoint servers that potentially are affected. What is really important is because they're stealing those cryptographic keys that they can basically play, and they're like machine level keys. Even if you patch, even if you remediate whatever you think is on the system, if they still have those keys and those keys haven't been rolled, they can always still come back and leverage that SharePoint server. So, but it looks like from what I've seen is there's a really easy PowerShell, and I don't know if it's a module that comes like it gets installed when you install SharePoint, so it's just part of now the PowerShell library. But there is a PowerShell commandlet that just update-sp machine key. So let me say that again: update-sp machine key. It's all one word there. That just automatically rotates the key, right? So really easy, I think, to rotate the key. Now, granted, I don't know what that necessarily breaks on the back end or if it breaks anything. That is something that also needs to be done in response to this if you are actually affected. So there's that aspect as well. I'm trying to think if there's anything else I was going to bring up on this. But, oh, and the other thing to pay attention to. So it looks like a lot of the research that's being done, if you look at the URL path, and I was calling this out and talking to someone else on the team earlier this week on this, was it seems like a lot of people are focusing on what has been seen by researchers. And obviously researchers, if they have a test instance or they're doing an investigation potentially where someone was effective, they pull in that data. Well, the data in the URL path is, you know, the URL path has layouts and it has like /15/ in the tool pane, or anything to do with the URL path has like that 15 in there. Something to note that if people are building just that raw detections, on like, I'm looking for this specifically, that 15 has to do with the version of SharePoint. So if you're running an older version, and I think the newest version is 16, don't 100% quote me on that, but I also feel like if you aren't taking the time to understand what's going on. Even if you're building off the research that's out there, you've still got to figure out the best way to apply it to you and make sense of it. And that's something that I think is worth noting, is if you're looking at the URL paths for things to look at in those and that kind of traffic, make sure that you are able to wildcard that 15 or do something with that 15 so that you're not caught there. But those are the things that I spent time looking at. And I think we even had an emerging threat that we pushed out that have 4 specific hunt packages in there. So if you do have community access, there's one of them that's definitely available with community access as well. So check that out if you're still concerned and don't know what to do with this. But yeah, that was kind of a roll up of kind of the stuff I was looking at and the stuff I learned through this kind of whole vulnerability exploit chain.
Love it, man. Well, since you've, got about 4 seconds of a breath, we'll go ahead and toss it right back to you and see what you got next for us this week.
Yeah, so I'm going to jump into, it's a HackMeg article. And it touches on something that I'm sure a lot of people have also been kind of like, oh, what are we going to do with this? But the title is Malware Lamehug Utilizes LLM to Generate Commands on Infected Machines. Basically, the backstory of this is I'm pretty sure it was the Russian actor. I don't think it's mentioning the specific actor here, but I think it was APT-28, if I had to recall from memory. From other articles, it was leveraging this. But either way, it was hitting Ukraine. And basically, it was a Python-based executable malware that embedded in it also had a query, so it can use the API to then use the large language model, which in this case was Qwen, was the language model being used, and that falls under, I forgot what LLM that is off the top of my head. But either way, the concept is that it was, hey, we're going to send prompts to this LLM via an API. It's going to give us what commands to run, and then it'll execute those commands. And people were kind of thinking like, this is what we feared, right? AI is going to basically hack for us and all this kind of stuff. And luckily, in this specific article, and this is why I like this one versus some of the other ones that just kind of have the, oh my gosh, freak out mode, is they do have a snippet of what some of this looks like. And for instance, like what the prompts look like. And in the prompt, it is role, right? Windows system administrator. So basically, it's telling the LLM, I am a Windows system administrator. And then the content is make a list of commands to create, a specific folder, which is program data info, and gather computer information, hardware information, process and service information, network information, 80 domain information, and execute it in one line and add each result to a text file in the program data info, info.txt. Return only commands without markdown. So what I love about this, and I'm sure you have used LLMs to help with doing things, is first off, if you're saying your role is a Windows administrator, that means it's going to find the most common way administrators would do this, which typically is a lot of the things attackers already do. So they're not like, it's not a net new attack or net new commands that you're basically going to see. And it's not going to be obfuscated. Let's be honest. There's nothing call out for obfuscating things, because that potentially could break things too if they even tried to roll that in there. And maybe the defenses or whatever, the controls, security gates would see that as maybe this is nefarious and not return the commands or return additional things that it doesn't want. So we should already be able to detect this for one. Right? Because a lot of the stuff is make a list of commands that copy recursively different Office and PDF documents. I mean, it's all about collection, potentially exfil, but reconnaissance. And it's just using lol bin type stuff, assumably, right? And the other thing I really like as far as looking at this is they constantly call out to try to maybe execute this in one line, right? So that means everything being done is not nearly as problematic of like, say, if it was a batch script where you have to like figure out what was really run other than you have the process executions. Like if it's in one line, that means it's going to be captured in most typical logging for command line, which is huge from a defender's perspective, because one, if you have a command line that's incredibly long, that's almost a kind of an indication, right? But then also you see this huge command line and you see all these processes spawn from something that also, you know, based on, you know, being a security professional, that hey, this looks like a reconnaissance, or there's probably detections that exist if you're looking for those types of behaviors. That we do it with threat hunting for sure. So I'm almost positive our threat hunts would detect this. Granted, we haven't seen a technical report that shows exactly what was run, so I'm, you know, assuming that claim. But I know when I use LLMs, the kind of stuff I get back, and I know that it's built on training off of what people do, and it's what happens in most environments that we look for. So yeah, I would say it's very interesting. They're leveraging this. I don't know how much they're gaining, especially if you're talking about APTs, an edge at this point. Now, if someone's never, ever done any kind of hacking and they don't know what to do at all, and they're not very computer literate, sure. But I don't think those are the attackers we're most concerned about anyways. But yeah, so what was your take? I know this has kind of been circling around.
No, you're good. I think, honestly, to me, it feels like a test. Because just like you said, the things that this is reported doing are not, like, you don't need an LLM for this, right? Mm-hmm. I don't know what value it really adds other than to say, hey, we used an LLM to do this. You know, I'm trying to think, and I guess I'll pose the question back to you, but I'm thinking, after reading this, you know, what are the forward-looking potentials of this kind of thing? Because in this form, it's not really going to do anything that new. And I personally would think that you would run into more errors than you would successes leveraging something like this in the form that it's being represented as. But I'm thinking, like, kind of outwardly, like, where would this kind of logic, this whole use of LLM to do these things, become an effective thing? You had mentioned maybe ease of use to allow people with less skill or understanding to be able to just leverage this tool to go and do a simple thing. That's probably in play. It's probably the top of the list, but I'm just going to throw my tinfoil hat on and think outward, especially if we're talking about, you know, a pretty sophisticated group like ABT28 potentially leveraging something like this. Like, I'm thinking forward, like, you know, do we see any versioning of these LLMs or something like this being able to accept the feedback itself and pivot and make decisions based on that feedback?
Yeah, I mean, like, I think it's like a proof of concept, but that's one thing, is there's not any, like, error correction where it validates whatever it did works. And I feel like the second you start trying to put in the validations, maybe it makes decisions off the next steps, all that kind of stuff. Now, if you're just looking at, like, you're familiar with the common LLMs that potentially could be used, and you're looking at what APIs look like, I feel like if you have just a host that's definitely not a production, like, server, like, you know, an actual host, it's doing API calls, like, a lot of them, because I imagine that's what it would look like. Be fairly quick, not just like if a person's, like, reading and doing and trying. That might also be a giveaway that why is there so much activity, and especially if it's, you know, an LLM that people don't commonly use in your environment. So it kind of comes back to that as well. So I do think web traffic is going to be a good telemetry for some of these things. It's kind of from, like, a behavior perspective that maybe a lot of people don't have, especially people working remote or off-prem kind of behaviors, you know, split tunneling. So you might not capture some of these things.
That C2, right?
Right. And it's kind of like this same idea. When you look at even C2 analytics, when you kind of look at rarity, frequency, all that kind of stuff, I think that would be a good tell when this matures to some level of that. But then I still feel like the amount of effort for something to get around defenses may not, I don't know. Like, I know eventually it could probably get there. I just feel like the amount of effort to get it there while people in the defense space are constantly working to counter it, it might not be as fruitful, or it might be more like one-off successes versus, like, it works and now it always works kind of. But that's just me, maybe my naivety or my assumptions. But I've just seen things where people freak out, and we have so many people that are always looking at how to address these things that they're never worth the complete freak out that occurs. It's good for people to pay attention for sure.
It's flashy, right? And maybe removing my tinfoil hat, maybe the layout here is designing something that creates the buzzword that could be sold out, you know, put out to market on that side of the world, you know, as a tool, like powered by AI, you know, leveraging the buzzwords and
show. Well, right. Like, you know, like all those like attack as a service or compromise as a service or all that kind of stuff. Like, this would be great for attackers on the black market to say, hey, if you want to get in this space, you could basically use our tool and it will basically help guide you through the attack. And you can just basically check all the things that you want. And then all those prompts will be in your package or payload. And there you go. Right. Mm-hmm. And, you know, that I could see being a potential problem because maybe more people will be more inclined to do things like that. But we already have that problem already with like ransomware groups and shelling out access with access brokers and things like that. So it doesn't really change too much other than there might be more people trying to get involved. But yeah, I don't know, like that's already a problem in a different way, and it hasn't, you know, luckily destroyed everything. It's just definitely caused some heartaches for a lot of people. So I don't know.
Yeah, and it's probably the same as on our side, right? Like we were constantly thinking about ways to leverage AI for different things. So that maybe this is just you're just looking at R&D, you know. I think I fall on that. You're just looking at R&D.
Yeah, and I think that's a good perspective. Like think about all the ways we've tried to use AI to actually solve what we try to do either from a work or defensive perspective. It hasn't solved everything for us. And we've spent a lot of like resources and money on that, which the attackers typically don't leverage the same amount of like hours, time, resource, money on their side. And if we haven't cracked the nut for how to use AI super effectively like we want to or dream of, where we've been dumping those resources and putting all these crackheads together to figure it out, I can't imagine that they're going to like outperform that. They're going to run into the same hurdles and figure out how to try to overcome the same things. So
yeah, it's gonna rely on the mothership of AGI to find its way to the surface to make that happen,
like,
I think.
Like if AI matures itself, like these models and things, that's what's gonna be the biggest groundbreaking thing. Like in fact they're like considering using it, I think, is just something to note.
For sure.
Yeah.
Well, circle.
So what do you got next?
All right, so I have an item from Catalyst titled Larva 208 New Campaign Targets Web3 Developers. So Larva 208 is known for its phishing attacks and social engineering tactics, targeting English-speaking IT staff through like phone calls and such. And they've adopted a new technique in their operations by shifting tactics to target Web3 developers with fake job offers and portfolio requests. So the victims are basically lured to fake AI workspaces and tricked into downloading malware disguised as an audio driver. The malware runs a PowerShell command to install the Fickle Stealer, which is basically used to gather system info, lists of installed software, geolocation data, all of that. It pulls that information, sends it off to whatever C2 controllers carry along with it. So there are a couple versions of how this was executed that was reported by Catalyst. So in one case, we have Larva 208 targeting Web3 developers on platforms like X and Telegram by sharing fake Norlax AI meeting links disguised as job interviews or portfolio reviews, and those links would then drive the malicious payload. And then on the second case, this one I found a touch more interesting because I think it was either last week or one of the previous weeks we talked about something similar. But in this case, after they posted the fake crypto analyst jobs on a legit site called Remote 3, the actor first holds a brief Google Meet call with the victim and then directs those applicants to a Norlax AI for that next stage, which is where they're going to deliver that malicious link there to bypass the platform safeguard. So what happens in this case is the victim would land on that fake AI workspace, and they would be queued to enter their email and an invite code to prove legitimacy. And then they're tricked into thinking that their mic isn't working on that. So something we see similar with like a deep fake with a fake Google Meet or a fake Zoom call. And then when their mic's not working, the person on the other end would drive to say, hey, you need to download this driver to make it work, prompting them to download this malicious audio driver. So that malware, as reported, is disguised as a Realtek HD audio driver. And once it's pulled, it'll execute a PowerShell command that fetches and runs that Fickle Stealer. And it will also load that payload for the Larva 208. I don't know why that's tripping me up, Scott, but it'll help load that C2 infrastructure. So again, the data collection that happens, you know, it'll pull all the info from the device, hardware, OS version, all these things, username, installed software, all the running processes. And it really does focus on targeting cryptocurrency wallet info and development credentials and project files for that side. Again, we're focused on Web3 developers here. And all that's sent packed up to the C2 servers. You know, one thing that I was trying to look at here, as we talked about before, we tend to always harp on this, and we will always harp on this, because it's just good medicine. When you're looking at a lot of different attacks, and they can have headlines that kind of point you to different things, and you know, it could be leveraging AI, or it could be doing X, or it could be this new variant or whatever. It's so common. I'd say like the 80% plus of the time, it's so common to see very common tactics executed alongside of this attack flow. In this case, we see something alongside of these drivers that's packaged. You'll see the PowerShell commands are basically fetch and execute commands like we commonly see with those flags to run as in a hidden window, the invoke web request commands. You know, you see your IEX or your IWR flags inside of the command. It's really straightforward. It's stuff we see all the time, but that's definitely part of this one. I'm going to try to think outside of the box of ways you might be able to detect this kind of campaign. One I thought, and I know there's been times that we've tried this in the past, Scott, where we've considered, like, I wouldn't call it so much of a structured hunt as more of a unstructured or maybe something in between, where you're kind of going after looking for those kinds of links, right? So you kind of look for these themed things. I'd be curious to see if you've had any thoughts over that over the years, because this one made me think of that, where you can kind of look for those, like, you know, hey, it's claiming to be this job offer for AI or something like this. You see these kinds of things that are there. Also, there's ways, and this would be more environment specific, but detecting those kind of audio driver downloads or driver downloads in any format, you should, in general, understand what's being driven in your environment, I would think. Even if you don't have like a crazy asset management program, I think this is one you can kind of scrape the data to really kind of look for anomalies in it. But yeah, there's nothing really crazy net new here. The key points that I took from this is really looking at that kind of like that deep fake, that kind of like drive people to these meetings, appear super legit, and then deliver it in these ways where you're actually holding meetings with these people as the, you know, as the attacker, and you're leading them down this path. And it's just a simple thing. It's like, oh, your mic's not working because you're on this platform. Here, download this driver, and boom, like you're all hyped up thinking you're going into an interview. You're becoming very vulnerable as the victim in that sense, because you've already walked these stages, and it's like, you're not really, most people are not going to think through this. So I see this kind of becoming more of a thing in articles that we've reported on, but even stuff that I've read that we haven't reported on. So definitely want to keep shouting to the rooftops about this one, but I'll take a breath, Scott. What did you think about this one?
No, I mean, I think it's interesting. The whole interview concept in general, right? It's like, you know, it's an attack on the human psyche where obviously these are positions that attackers know either turn over quickly or potentially they're positions that are either underpaid or they're not happy or maybe hard to find jobs, right? Like you got these like different perspectives. But there's nothing worse that, you know, when you go to an interview, no matter what it is, like, it's like a first impression anxiety, right? You want to leave the best mark you have. And so for them to come in and be like, oh, your audio is not working, you are not going to question anything because you want to seem competent. You want to get things resolved quickly. Like if you fumble trying to get your mic to work in an interview, you know, your biggest concern is like I'm supposed to be technical and I can't even get my mic to work, you know, like, so you're almost willing to do anything and they're totally taking advantage of that. So that is always interesting, like how cruel that kind of can be, right? Just playing on our insecurities in a way. But you know, as I'm sitting here looking at it's such a simple article, such a simple attack. And I kind of was doing a callback to how I looked at security in the past, to how I look at it now. And I remember when I used to see things like this, my first, instinct was, what website are they going to? And, you know, are there any other ones that look similar to that website? You know, or is there a hash I can get for the file so I can like look for that as a way to deal with this type of attack? And man, it's like I could care less where they pull the payload down from. I actually don't even pay much attention to that anymore. And that's kind of the transition I love when I see stuff like this. This is so simple, is because one, think about the logic of a shortcut file. Like a shortcut file really is to exist to run something that you already have on your machine, right? So why would downloading a shortcut file have any functionality at all, right, on your machine? So if you see LNK files being dropped in locations that don't make sense, that like aren't the desktop or maybe within the program file structure on Windows, and it's in your downloads, huge suspect. I don't even care what it is. It shouldn't exist, right? So just things like that to be like, wow, that's something. And then also PowerShell, you know, running a hidden window and downloading things, but even fetching the download things in general, I'm more interested in that because that is not as common either. And what's great is if I focused on like this specific attack and this is how people are doing things, and they're getting someone to basically download a PowerShell script and run it, and that's how they're getting their the fickle malware on the machine, and that was what I was focused on, I might miss the idea that if this is a technique that's used by a lot of people, and if I were to focus on just that technique of the PowerShell, looking at a hidden window or not, but also looking at, you know, executing something that's being web requested, that's a big thing to identify that could help me with this specific type of campaign, future campaigns, and, you know, past campaigns if I was looking for it. So that's what I like about this. It's so simple. Is if you look for the wrong thing, you still kind of are chasing your tail. If you're paying attention to the right things, this becomes an easy defensive strategy. And also, if you don't have these types of defenses in place, like we talked about, these behaviors, then not only did you help with this specific thing, but you know, you're so forward thinking that they'll have to completely change how they operate, which is kind of what we were taught early on in our security journey or whatever it is, you know, how do we make the actors behave differently? That's how we can affect them. Well, if we focus on, you know, where their infrastructure is or the IOCs around it, we're not really making them try very hard. But this is a great example of the difference between the two, I think, just because it's such a simple and well-explained write-up. So those are the two things. The psyche thing is crazy to me because it's just so abusive. And then, you know, just the techniques.
Yeah, I can't see that approach from the social engineering side being, you know, thwarted very often when people find themselves down that layer of the chain, right?
But right.
Yeah, that part, we should always echo that, Scott. I mean, it should really be, I mean, it's becoming kind of a soft theme of the show a little bit, but it's great medicine. Like considering these things that are commonly used, like you just said, like you're like, hey, you know, this is a thing that's targeting Web3 developers, and we're a Web3 developing shop. So we're considering just looking at this. But when you really look at it or you think about it, like you're leveraging that, and your return on that time spent doing that hunt is covering down on so many other threats because of the commonality of that technique. And it's just,
right.
It's just good to think about if, you know, any of the hunters are listening or any people running programs, like it's a really great way to represent your efforts, your time, and the ROI of it.
And, you know, what's kind of beautiful about this is obviously it still works, right? These techniques they're doing. And so that just tells you that if you're relying on your tools that you buy to detect that specific behavior, good luck. Now, will they detect potentially the malware that's being installed? Yeah, maybe. But I would rather, I mean, having both is great, but if I had to rely on knowing a third party has, you know, my ass covered, essentially, you know, I kind of would rather put some control in my own hands on how I can confidently say I can detect things in the future. And I think that's the behavior threat hunting approach for sure.
Absolutely. All right, what do you got last for us this week, Scott?
What do I have last? Oh, yeah. So this one was just kind of fun. It was a TechCrunch article, and it's called "A Surveillance Vendor Was Caught Exploiting a New SS7 Attack to Track People's Phone Locations." So SS7, it's the Signaling System 7. It's a private set of protocols that's kind of used by global phone carriers to help route subscribers' calls and text messages around the world. But if you have access to this information, you can basically use it to track people based on what cell towers they're connected to. And even in places with lots of cell towers, get within meters of accuracy of where they're actually physically located, right? And, you know, some of this stuff that they use this for is for so they can have accurate billing and stuff from that perspective. And, you know, it's not surprising. This has been done before. There's people that will do it to try to track people from outside the country. There's to spy on their own people. And then there's people that maybe sell that data or get contracted out to basically they have ends for this. It is supposed to be pretty well guarded. There's controls and safety controls that are put in by the phone carriers to protect these types of protocols and data. But obviously it's a great, depending on what your business is, right, or what your purpose is, it's a great set of data to have. And, you know, to me, it's just interesting because, well, I already knew this existed, but it's just kind of like a step back of like, yeah, this is just what happens when you use technology that people don't realize, right? Any kind of technology you touch, you're leaving fingerprints. So, you know, I equate this to if you walk through your house or someone's house with muddy shoes, it's just the same thing as if you're using a cell phone or a smartphone, you're using a computer, or using all sorts of different types of apps on those things. You know, how easy it is to really track all that. Now, granted, where the expertise comes into play, well, imagine you have 100 people to walk through your house with muddy shoes. How do you just, you know, differentiate between those two? That's where, you know, you need the expertise, the people that are actually built on, like, I know how to interpret this data, filter this data, whatever. So I kind of was just kind of using this to kind of talk about that perspective on, like, what do we really expect when we use technology? There was something not long ago that surprised people, and that was people were able to track you based on your notifications that you would get for your apps on your phone. And that was like a novel way to track you because the notifications are based on time, get sent out and get cached in specific servers or something. I forgot the exact technical specifications around why that was. But basically, it was a constant ping, and they would have to get routed to you. And it was a way for people to track you just because of the settings you have set up for convenience. Just more of a, hey, I just wanted to call out, if you use technology, you should always be aware that these things are possible. So be responsible in the things you do. Understand your risks. Why you know, you may or may not be a target. All those things need to be considered. And this is why it's always concerning when you have people in high positions of power that do not consider these things just because it's basically naivety or ignorance at that point. And so yeah, I just wanted to kind of bring that up and maybe get your, you know, 2 cents on some of those things. But it's always interesting when people are like shocked by this, I guess. But also, it's not hard with the data. I mean, if you've looked at data ever or ever had to investigate anything, there's a lot of data that can exist that doesn't always exist. But man, that data, collecting the right type of data, can tell a really big story, and it can just be metadata even at that.
You know, I've branching into a bit of a story on this one. I've had discussions with friends and family, you know, when they talk about or start becoming more hip to the idea that they have all these different things that are able to track their stuff, right? Like that common thing you hear is like, man, I just talked about, buying this new device or whatever. And then suddenly I'm served up with 100 ads on all these apps for that device. It's like, there are technologies under the technology. There's so much out there, so much we don't even know about. I don't think any one person understands the depths of all the different pieces of the technology that are out there that can play a part in doing these kinds of things. And the way that the world has adopted technology so fast over the course of the last just 50 years, right? There's so much that we just are signing off on and moving away through, right? Like we're not considering the security of our cell phone providers. We're not, you know, people just aren't doing that. They're not thinking about even how to ask that question, right? Unless there's some major compromise that's reported publicly that might, you know, draw your attention to it and say, oh, you know, maybe this cell company they seem to have shown that they're not secure. So I'm going to go with this other one who hasn't reported any compromise. When I read these kinds of articles, this is the things I'm thinking about. It's like, so how do we in this society find a way to ask the right questions? Because what I always come back to, Scott, when I'm looking at this and when I'm having those conversations with friends and family, it's seemingly the only way to avoid falling into some of these potholes sometimes is to just not partake. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Like there are definitely triggers and switches in different applications to be able to limit your exposure, but you just can't limit it all without unplugging the thing, you know?
Right.
And well, it's always that mix, that trade-off conversation. You know what I'm getting at?
Yeah. And I like the comment how, you know, when people are like, man, I was just talking about this and now I'm seeing ads on this or whatever, you know, you know, when you first heard that, you're like, well, that is kind of weird, but whatever. I don't think it's anecdotal anymore because everybody says that, right?
Yep.
It's not like, oh, this happened and it happened as one person. And isn't that crazy? Like literally I've experienced it. People I know around me have experienced it. And if everybody's experienced it, I feel like there's something definitely going on, right? As far as that goes. But it also comes back to some information doesn't really mean much. But you find someone who's really, really smart and purpose driven, and they find ways to use it that is so outside the box that now it becomes a vulnerability as far as the data that's being exposed versus it used to be just a random series of numbers, right? But now there's a pattern they discovered and now it means something, whatever, you know? And I kind of attribute this similar to, you know, when people used to try to brute force networks and they didn't know what were valid usernames or passwords. But by just looking at the amount of time for responses, they were able to use that telemetry to determine they found a valid username. They just had the wrong password because the machine would immediately say, oh, that is a valid username. Let me go validate this password real quick. And that difference in time versus saying this isn't a valid user was enough where just that information, they were able to build upon that as an attacker to say, now I just got to figure out what the password is, right? And that's kind of the thing when we talk about data or information in general that is so impactful. Like how will we ever think that was something that could be that we need to figure out how to protect to make sure all the responses are in the same amount of time regardless, right? You know? And so that's when I say there's people that are smart when they get access to certain types of data, they find ways to use it that have value to them. Or if they have the data and someone else finds value, they figure out how to then sell that data. And that's why data is just a huge market in itself. People talk about all sorts of things that are going to make money in the future. I think data is like the biggest thing once they figure out how to use it even more effectively. And you don't have the privacy concerns, which I don't know how you avoid all that. But yeah, so
I don't think you can. I think you run into these things where it's just, you know, and you even see it, right? So just like you said, you know, they're not those kind of comments of like, hey, that's serving up these ads that I was just talking about something. They're no longer anecdotal. And I think what you see too is it's almost like a radical acceptance of, yeah, we know it's fine, you know.
Well, and it's like, if you want the convenience and lifestyle we have, you have to accept certain things, right?
Yep.
And if you want things to appear free, you also have to accept certain things. There's because like it matters the amount of free things we actually get. If we didn't do an ad driven, data driven currency on the back end of that, most of us wouldn't even be able to afford this lifestyle, or those businesses wouldn't even be able to offer the types of services because they wouldn't have enough money to support them. You know what I mean? So it's like, I mean, that's the catch 22. So then it comes back to when it comes to your privacy, what are the things that we actually need to protect, which are the things that, you know, we would be nice to, or if we're paranoid, we want it protected. And that's a tough one to answer because it's very personal, different per person, right?
Well, I think a good analogy is, you know, you own a car. You don't want your car to be stolen. Do you just stop owning a car, or do you lock your car and, you know, put an alarm system on it, take the protections you need to prevent that theft, right? It's kind of like that. So you kind of have two choices. You can either just not have a car, or you can protect it. So, you know, the threat of it being stolen is always going to be there. It's kind of like, yeah, here, like you have a digital footprint in today's society. You can't really avoid it unless you just completely unplug and you just stay off of anything digital ever, or away from anything digital.
Yeah, I feel like honestly, transparency would be the best. Like when I sign into a service and I get all these things, if they had the things itemized, like, hey, we do this, this, and this, and this, that you know, things I understand what they are, and I like the concept. I'm like, oh, right. Yeah, I want my car to remember where I live so it can self-drive its way home. You know, like that sounds nice, but then what's the cost of that? If they can equate that to, by doing that, you are sharing this information. This is being stored here. It's being backed up here. If you're worried about your address being out there, which is already out there publicly in other forms, and if they can even disclose that, then, you know, that would be much better. And you say, yeah, no, use my information for that. I like that, you know, versus you have no idea. I think that's really the big problem.
Yeah. And I think you dare to dream, because I just can't see anybody offering up that information easily to make you make an emotional decision versus
that, not like wrapped in like a user agreement, legal speak that you wouldn't understand. Like no one wants
to. You won't understand that. You just click and move on because you want the toy. You want the product. And
honestly, you know, that's like my favorite thing. I think that ChatGPT or other LLMs would help with is all those like accepted user agreements. Just copy that bad boy, paste it in there and say, what am I owing?
Can you lawyer this in layman's terms for me, please?
Right. And I think more people should do that so that they either have to get better or be held more accountable for, you know, those types of services too. Right. Cause that's probably going to be called out in there in some way, not specific. Right. So yeah, I just thought it was an interesting piece to talk about. Privacy a little bit, but also understanding, like, you know, what we accept as a culture, society, and what technology brings, but what's the cost, you know?
Yep.
I think that kind of closes out the main articles here. I just want to make a few mentions. We do have our Intel-Driven Threat Hunting workshop, Analyzing Malware Behaviors. It is a live workshop where you can interact with data. It is 2 hours long, starting at 11 a.m. to 1 p.m. on July 31st, 2025. So make sure to register so that it's easier to find things if you can't actually attend, but it's a good resource if you're really interested in getting your hands on data and looking for malware behaviors. Also, we will be at Black Hat. Tommy here will be there in person. I'm not making it this year, but stop by the Black Hat booth at 5742, the Intel 471 booth. And with that, I want to thank everyone for joining our Out of the Woods Threat Hunting podcast. Looking forward to syncing back up next week. And that will close out our top threat hunting headlines for the week of July 21st, 2025. Happy hunting.
Happy hunting, everyone.